So, let's start with a question. Okay. In the spirit of people like Pascal that were thinking about games and probability back in the 1600s, here's a little offer. Get to roll a pair of dice 20 times. Each dice, is standard six-sided die. So you roll the die, and if you get two sixes, that's a 12. And that's the only way to get 12. And if you get a 12 out of at least once over your 20 rolls, I give you $1. Otherwise, you give me $1. This is the kind of stuff they were thinking about. Should you play? Maybe you took discrete math. How would you solve a problem like this?
Probability of getting a 12 20 times.
Well, you only need to get 12 once to win, right? How about the probability of not getting a 12 20 times? What's the probability of not getting a 12 if we just roll the dice once?
Thirty-five out of 36.
Yeah. Right. There's 36 things that could happen, right? And they're all equally likely. Only one of those things gets you a 12. So the question is, these are the odds. Is 35 over 36 to the power of 20? Less than a half, right? if less than half the time you roll, you never get a 12, then this is a good deal, right? Because you have a greater than half chance of winning. But if more than half, right, then that would mean more than half the time you play the game, you never get a 12. Now, if you know about logarithm tables, then this can be a lot easier, right? Probably let's just write as fractions right now. Actually, those logarithms are negative. So maybe another way to ask it is the other way around. Take the logarithms of the reciprocals, then the numbers involved are bigger than 1, hence actually positive. I have long since memorized that this is about 0.69, and I know from calculus that this should be about a 35th, because the log of 1 is 0 and the slope of the logarithm curve is 1 at 1. So I'm wondering, is 20 over 35 bigger than 0.69? I believe the answer is no. Your odds are actually slightly less than half of winning. That's not too hard to see. If you compare this to, say, we'll just take 30, 35 and multiply it by 6, right? You get 180 and then 30, so you get 210, right? So that'd be my modern approach to solving it, using all my modern tools. It did require one bit of memorization right there. And you can, of course, if you want to get, you know, what is the fair number of rolls, if there is a fair number. I don't think any integer number of rolls is exactly fair. I looked at the logarithm values, and I think the fair number, right, is, I mean, you'd want to take the logarithm of 2 and divide it by the logarithm of 36 35ths, and that number, I computed, it was somewhere between 24 and 25, I think. So if you were given 24 rolls, this would be slightly not in your favor. 25 rolls, you have a slightly better than half chance of winning. So if you played it many, many times, you would make money on average with high probability. So that's the kind of thing that Pascal is thinking about. Right? Bless you.
Thank you.
Now, the reason Pascal's triangle is named Pascal's triangle, even though he wasn't the first guy to consider, is that he's the one that has basically the most famous book about it, right? And he used Pascal's triangle in a new way. He was using it not just for a binomial theorem, right, not just to expand binomials, but he was using it to understand probability. That's the key, is that he connected Pascal's triangle, even though the triangle was known before, but he connected it with probability, and that's the new thing. Famous book, A Treatise on the Arithmetical Triangle. Okay. We talked before about the probabilistic interpretation of this thing, right? He made these nice connections with probability. He also thought, hey, this is a very interesting triangle of numbers. Let's just figure out what we can about it. So he studied it for its own sake. And for one of his propositions, he explicitly appeals. Actually, he explicitly uses an inductive argument. Right? So he's using mathematical induction. His argument is, okay, I want to show you such and such is true about Pascal's triangle. The claim is, the proposition looks like this. It's n choose these two ratios, and it equals, I think it's n plus 1. I better check my notes. N plus 1 n minus k minus k plus 1 n minus k. And so how is it inductive? Well, he says, okay, well, if you look at the first row of the triangle, this is obvious because the ratios involved here is like 1 to 1. There's hardly anything going on there. You're looking at, not quite the tippy top, but like the next row where it's just two ones. It's all trivial. And then he claims, okay, well now I claim that, you know, if this is ever true at any given row, right, then I claim it's true at the next row. But I probably don't even have it written right, do I? Yeah. Should have just looked at my notes at the beginning. Okay. Now the night. So this ratio then, this is pretty nice, right? Because this, if you believe this fact, then it allows you to get the multiplicative formulas, right? I mean, the way he defined the triangle was, okay, you start at, I'm using modern notation here. I don't claim Pascal used exactly this notation, but he starts with the left column is just all ones, right? And then to get all the rest of the triangle, you have this rule where to get a given element of the triangle, you look at what's above and one to the left, and you add them. There's kind of a corner case you have to deal with, which is what if there's nothing above you? And the way that's dealt with is you just, if there's nothing above you, you just add nothing. So to handle that kind of corner case, you have just that. All right, so the first non-trivial instance is here. 1 and 1 add to 2.
So for example, four and six is 10 again.
Now, the interesting thing about this ratio, right, is not all obvious from this additive definition. So if you believe this ratio, then you have this nice result that from the ratios, you can iterate it. So to go down one by one from this, right? So like say to get the ratio from 10 to 5, for example, what would that correspond to in terms of this notation, right? It's 5 choose 2 versus 5 choose 1. Okay? So the k is a... If the k plus 1 here is the 2, then the k is just 1. So this is 2... And then 5 minus 1, 4. All right. Yes. So 5 tenths is 2/4. It works. Now, if you run that backwards, what you end up with is n over 1 times this one. N over k, and then you repeat that again. Go to the arithmetic. N minus k minus 1 for k. That's what happens if you run it backwards. Now, let's say I do that again. Run it backwards one more time. And you get n minus k minus 2 over k minus 1. And you can repeat this process until this gets all the way down to 0, until the column is 0. So the intellectual significance of Pascal's work here is connecting, in this example, the intellectual significance of this particular proposition. He had many other propositions about this triangle of numbers. This particular proposition's significance is that it goes from additive definition to multiplicative formula. So what will happen then if we just keep repeating this all the way to 0? Well, we get exactly the modern formula that involves a factorial. Countdown from k to 1 in the denominator, and a countdown from k minus 1 to 0, this is just 1. So that's, so Pascal figured out this kind of formula because he was aware that, okay, with this I can just repeatedly use this ratio. And so if you put all this together, right, in our modern notation, it'll look like this is what I write in Sigma Kappa's 2 class when I talk about the binomial series. I write it this way. Think about, you know, the Pascal's triangle in terms of coefficients for the binomial theorem. It's pretty easy to do an inductive argument to show that the coefficients have to satisfy these rules. For example, I know how these are supposed to line up, so that's why I'm writing it this way. When you take this formula and multiply it by A, you get this thing. Take that formula and multiply it by B, you get this thing. So something's supposed to satisfy the binomial theorem. Then this is how you want to make the definition. That's the only way to do it. So if you're going to have the binomial theorem captured by your Pascal's triangle, you have to define it this way, or you have to define it in something equivalent. There's no choice. It has to have that additive property. The fact that it also has the multiplicative property, that multiplicative formula, is what's interesting about this key proposition here. Pascal proved other things, of course. Like, one of the other things the book mentions is that Pascal said, take some element of the triangle, like say this 10 here. Now go one column to the left and look at all the numbers above it. 1, 3, 6, it adds up to 10. Here, if that's 5, go one column to the left, look at all the stuff above it. You get 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 ones. Adds up to 5. Here, with this 10, one column left, 4, 3, 2, 1 adds up to 10. Lots of stuff like that. Another thing you can do is just add up all the rows. I mean, just add up each row separately. So, like, if you apply the binomial theorem of A and B equal to 1, you get 2 to the n equals a sum of binomial coefficients times 1s. So, like, if you add up row 3 here, indeed, 1 plus 3 plus 3 plus 1 is 8, which is 2 to the third. 1 plus 5 plus 10 plus 10 plus 5 plus 1 is 32, which is 2 to the fifth. The Pascal's triangle has lots of fun properties because it has connections with probability, right? I mean, the n choose k is the number of subsets of size k of an n-element set. And it has this multiplicative thing. It also has all these algebraic properties. So it's a very fruitful thing to investigate mathematically. You can find lots of interesting patterns in it once you get the idea to look at it. And you need some... I mean, the more modern your notation is, the easier it'll be for you to express these patterns and try to prove them. The notation of the 1600s is not 100% modern, but it's getting a lot closer, as we've seen. Now, there's a guy, Dutch guy, I'm probably not going to pronounce his last name correctly. Huygens, or Huygens, I'm really not sure. This guy published a book on probability that that he was aware of Pascal's work, and he, and this is also in the mid-1600s. One of the things you see is that there are more people communicating about math across the European continent. They write letters to each other. Right? Pascal's in, not in the same place as Huygens, but they're sending letters to each other. And with the printing press, if a letter is really awesome, somebody typesets it, right, and edits it and becomes a book. And so ideas spread around more rapidly. And so we'll see that progress, you know, the exchange of ideas is getting, it's getting faster and more rapid. And it's a combination of things. There's more people that actually have the education and the spare time and the money to, you know, actually make progress on this stuff. And they can exchange information with each other. It's not as expensive to have a, you know, a copy of, say, Euclid's Elements once it's been typeset and you have a printing press, for example. So Pascal implicitly and Huygens much more explicitly consider the concept of expected value. Pascal talks about it in terms of like there's some kind of game and there's a certain number of outcomes, and some outcomes are equally likely, one is not, and the idea is, okay, if we stop the game early so that we haven't decided who's going to win all the money in the middle of the table, say, you know, if we stop the game early, how can we decide how to fairly split up the money because we had to stop the game early? You know, if it's just a simple thing of, oh, okay, either you or I is going to win or lose, okay, well, we'll just call it a tie and we each take half the money if we have to quit early. But it could be a more complicated thing where, say, one person has to win twice. There's going to be a two-round game. And the other person only has to win once. Well, if the rounds are independent, then, like it was just flipping a coin each time or something, then you would say, okay, there's four equally likely possibilities, and only one of them in which the one player wins twice. So he should only get a fourth of the money if they stop the game there, right? Because he's only got a one-fourth chance of winning the pot. And they can, Pascal considered more elaborate scenarios. And Huygens got a little more explicitly mathematical in terms of, you know, talking about all the probabilities, a lot closer to the modern version of it. So, what is expected value? And how would you? It's just the average outcome weighted by probabilities, right? In terms of, you know, some kind of gambling, you know, if the payoff is, you know, A, P times out of N,
B Q times out of N and 0 all other times. Right? So if it's a kind of game where it's, you know, they play it out N times, P out of N times, you get payoff A, Q out of N times, you get payoff B, otherwise you get nothing, right? Then, of course, the expected value the probability weighted average . So we'd imagine if playing this game n times, there would be p times a paid and plus q times b paid. But if we only play it once, we should just take an average, right? So just take an n, 1 over n of that, right? It's a weighted average. The way we usually think about it in modern terms is we think of each value multiplied by the probability of each outcome multiplied by the probability of that outcome. And of course, 0 for the other outcomes. So if these are the only ones we actually get anything of, would be the fair value of the game. So, for example, what about our earlier game, right? The 20 chances for 12. Right? What's the expected value of that game? Well, you get a dollar if you get the 12. You pay a dollar if you don't get the 12, right? So there are if you do 20, 36 to the power 20, let's think of all the different possible games that could happen, right? Out of those, 35 to the 20, you don't get a 12. So the remainder are the ones where you do get a 12, possibly multiple times. So we do 1 times, this will be the probability of getting a 12. But then we lose a dollar. In the other case, right, the 35 to the 20 out of 36 to the 20 games in which you would not get a 12. You can simplify that a little bit. Is anybody familiar with Pascal's wager? It's a philosophical argument. It's a philosophical argument that Pascal gave for believing in God. If you accept the premises, then it's a good argument, but people have disputed the premises as being unrealistic. I believe in God, but I don't think the premises of this argument are realistic at all. The premise is that there's only two possibilities. Basically, he's thinking of the Christian God and then the materialist possibility. There's no God at all. But philosophically, you should allow infinitely many other possibilities besides those two, which ruins the argument. The premise is... There's just these two possibilities. The Christian God, so you can believe in that God and get infinite reward in the afterlife at maybe a finite cost in this life. Right? If you choose to believe in this God, and that's a whole other philosophical issue. Can you just choose to believe whatever you want and really believe it? Or you don't choose to believe in the Christian God, and if the Christian God is real, well, then your payoff is negative infinity in the afterlife. But if there is no God, then your payoff is always finite because there's just this life, and Pascal's thinking it's going to be fine or not. So we have the expected value in if you go with his premises of only considering Christian God and no God at all. Then the expected value of believing in the Christian God would be be something finite times the let's let P be the probability God exists. So there's a finite there's some kind of finite. If God doesn't exist, then there's only this life, so your payoff in the game is finite. It could be finite, positive, or negative. He's thinking in terms of, well, that you have to make sacrifices to be a good Christian. But if God does exist, then you get an infinite reward in the afterlife, which will outweigh whatever finite costs you pay in this life. And so this is finite, right? This is a number between 0 and 1, right? So, if you believe that P is even non-zero, right? And so Pascal thinks it's at least positive. If you believe that there's at least a positive probability, even if it's not 100%, right? Then this has to be infinity times any positive number should be infinity. If that argument. So that's the expected value, the probability weighted average, and so. And of course, not believing in the Christian God, according to this, is some finite number. Maybe there's some benefits in this life to not believing, but then you have a. Infinite penalty in the afterlife, if there is an afterlife. Of course, this is a
easy thing to take apart in a freshman philosophy class, because you can say, well, maybe with some positive probability there's a shy God that rewards people that don't believe in him, or something weird like that. And then you get stuff like infinity minus infinity in your effect, in your expected value. It's not a good argument for believing in God, but it gives you an idea of the kind of probabilistic thinking that was arising. There's some other stuff going on, including some work by Fermat. We talked about Fermat last time. He wasn't just doing analytic geometry. He was also doing some very important stuff in number theory. I don't know, has anybody studied cryptography? Like, you connect to a website and it's secure, supposedly. So you can enter your credit card number and no one else is listening in. All right. So one of the modern one of the cryptography methods, public key cryptography, for example, uses what we call Fermat's little theorem extensively. If you have a prime, and then you have an integer, and then you raise it to not the power of the prime, but just one less than that, then what you get is equal to 1 mod p. Back then, it was just a result of pure theory. It wasn't super important until computer networks, and it became practical to automate a bunch of little number theory computations doing lots of modular arithmetic. Use that to do some clever encryption. Now, This is a... This is an interesting idea. The method of infinite descent. This is kind of like an induction proof run backwards. Okay? So let me just try and show you the connection. So here's what I would call strong mathematical induction. If P is true, let's say it depends on a parameter, not about it. So if P is true of 1, and for all n, if you look at all the previous, if it's true everywhere before, then somehow you can use the fact that it's true everywhere before n to prove that it's also true at n. Then for all n, this is true. Right? So if it's true at 1, and then for any n, you can show that if it's been true so far, it'll be true again. Then it just keeps being true. Now, you can rephrase this. Strong induction in terms of where is the first place where something fails, right? If something is not always true, then there has to be a place where it breaks down, where there's some end where it failed. Even though it was true at all earlier times. Maybe it breaks down at the very beginning. Okay? So the way you can... So if you look at where P is false, if it's false anywhere, there's a first place where it's false. Okay? And the same reasoning can work... If you're talking about places where P is false, you could also... talk about some property's negation. So false becomes true. So another way to say it is you look at the set of all numbers where some property is false. So if you think about this reasoning, so if you have a set of natural numbers, and it's not empty, then it has a least element, right? Because if it didn't have a least element, then you could say, okay, 1 is not an S, and then for any n, I'm going to assume I have the property not being an S for all previous numbers, and that has to imply that n is also not an S, because otherwise that would be a least element of S. So that would be a contradiction. So if a set of natural numbers is not empty, then it has a least element. And another way to think about this is what would it mean for a set to not have a least element? That would mean for any element, I could find a lesser element. And I could do that repeatedly. So I could build up a sequence. And I had a set of natural numbers with no least element, then I could, I could pick an element, and then I could pick an element and set lesser than that one, then pick one lesser than that one, then pick one lesser than that one, and so on. Right? So you can think of at least strong mathematical induction as equivalent to the idea that if you have some natural numbers in sequence, right, the sequence can't decrease forever. Eventually, it's got to, it's got to stop somewhere. Even if it goes all the way to 1, then it's got to stop at 1. If it doesn't go all the way down to 1, it stops somewhere else. So you should think of induction and this idea of method of infinite descent as being connected, because logically, it's equivalent to a strong form of induction, right? Where instead of just using p at n minus 1 to prove pn, you use all the previous instances to prove the next one. So for example, he proved that there do not exist natural numbers a, b, and c with a to the fourth minus b to the fourth equaling c squared. By showing that any such a, b, c, if you had a, b, c that satisfy that, they imply, and he argued how you could use them to cook up an infinite, strictly decreasing sequence of natural numbers. This goes. You can use, if you want to do a simpler argument, the book walks through that argument. It's not a simple argument. It fills a whole paragraph. You have to read it pretty closely. A simpler version of how you could use infinite descent is say you want to prove the square root of 2 is irrational. Right? That's a simpler one. You'd probably appreciate it a little more. So suppose what you do is you argue for a contradiction. You say, suppose it's rational, so there's a fraction of the natural numbers whose square is 2, right? Then a squared equals 2b squared, right? So a squared is even, but we know that an odd number times an odd number is odd, so if a was odd, a squared would be odd, right? But it's not. So a is even. Say a is equal to two, let's call this one A, we'll think of this as, I'm going to think of these as A1 and B1, because they're going to be the start of how we get a descending, infinite descending sequence. So let's say that it's 2 times A2. So now you have 2B1 squared is equal to the square of 2A2, which is 4A2 squared. So B1 squared is equal to 2A2 squared. So B1 squared is even. So again, odd times odd is odd. So if B1 times B1 is even, then B1 is itself even. Say B1 is equal to 2 times B2. So now you have that 2 times A2 squared is equal to 2B2 quantity squared, which is 4B2 squared. So now I have A2 squared. I'm going to divide both sides by 2, equals 2B2 squared. And so now we're back where we started. Right. So now we can repeat the argument. Now we could use this A2 and B2 again, and then we would get an A3 and a B3. Right? And each time, we're getting something twice as big. So we get this infinite decreasing sequence of natural numbers. But if you don't believe there's an infinite decreasing sequence of natural numbers, and I don't, right? It's pretty much baked into the definition, any definition of natural numbers. Then there can't be a solution, right? The A's and B's are going to keep decreasing. This is essentially the same argument that you've seen before. It's like the ancient Greeks used, where you assume the fraction A over B is written in least terms, right? Because if it was written in least terms, right, you couldn't have A1 and B1 both be even. So what would you be doing by writing the fraction in least terms? By canceling out all the common factors of 2 right at the beginning. You'd be selecting a minimal solution, right? It boils down to the use of the fact that if you have a solution at all, there's a least solution, right? So in terms of all the possible A1s that might be a solution, there's a least one, right? And so this is another way of doing the same argument. Instead of saying, assume we start in least terms, just say, okay, assume we start with any solution, and then show how you can always get a lesser solution, right? In the sense that you can get the numerator to be lesser. And well, in this case, you can also get the denominator to be lesser. But either one of these sequences is a contradiction with how we think of the natural numbers, right? You can't have natural numbers that just keep decreasing forever. Eventually you hit. If you kept decreasing, You either stop somewhere before 1 or you stop at 1. If you're already at 1,000, you can only decrease 999 more times. Then you've hit 1. Now, the last thing I should mention, right, is projective geometry. It's also introduced in the mid-1600s by another guy whose name I'm not going to be able to pronounce.
De Sarguay.
Sarguay. Okay, I have a handout related to this. I'm just going to draw the things from Wikipedia. This is how we think about projective geometry in modernity. The idea is, so he came up with this, it's really cool. Okay. So we always have the idea of lines intersecting at a point. Right, that's not new. But then he said, if you have a bunch of parallel lines, the idea is, let's introduce an abstract concept of a point at infinity. Okay. Now, different sets of parallel lines, or if you have these parallel lines, and then maybe here's some other parallel lines, right? These intersect at a different point at infinity. Okay? And in a given plane, the set of all points at infinity is the line at infinity. And why would you want to do this? well, most people thought that way. They didn't appreciate this at all because it was kind of against the spirit of the times. The hot new stuff was Fermat and Descartes and their analytic geometry, turning everything into algebra and back and forth between algebra and geometry. Whereas this is very much old school in the it's synthetic geometry. You're not doing lots of algebra here with coordinates and so on. I mean, the very fact that you're talking about, you know, points at infinity is going to cause all sorts of problems when you try and do algebra with this stuff. Right? This is trying to build on the ancient Greek geometry. The point is, when you do this, and then when you take projections, so think like you have something, and then you cast its shadow onto a plane. All conics, right? The point is, conic sections, once you allow for points at infinity, what Desargues figured out was that the conic sections are exactly the projections of circles. In fact, you only need one circle, and just any circle. Just take any circle, and if you project it the right way, you can get whatever conic section you want. Like, here's an example. Okay, I'm going to try and draw in 3D, so watch out. Okay, here's a circle kind of lying flat on the table, and then here's a vertical wall that touches the circle. It kisses it at it. And so the wall touches the circle. And let's say I put a light source right here. Okay. And this line here is parallel with that plane, with that wall. Okay. Now, what is the shadow that my light source will cast on the wall? It's a parabola. If I didn't have the light source exactly parallel, I could get something different, right? If the light source was a little bit to the right, then the shadow would be an ellipse. If the light source was a little bit to the left, then the shadow I would get would be one arm of a hyperbola. So I don't know, I guess you can get a flashlight and a ring, maybe a big hula hoop or something, and hold them up next to a wall and in the dark. Now, of course, he actually proved this, in the style of Euclid and so on, right? He was building on Apollonius' conic section, but. And this stuff is in the modern times still very interesting. I mean, I was reading a paper last weekend just about some new result in projective geometry using some stuff from mathematical logic. What time is it?
Oh, okay. I'm over time, so very quick.